Hello and welcome to this edition of The Autograph with me, Susan Wadaris. This week, I'm sitting down with author Grant Smith to talk about his new book, Spy Trade, as he puts forth formidable and dangerous evidence of Israeli espionage activities in the United States and its long-term influence and consequences for U.S. governance. So stay tuned. Grant F. Smith is director at the Washington, D.C.-based Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy, an independent nonprofit that studies U.S. policy formulation toward the Middle East. Smith's research and analysis on trade, law enforcement, and opportunity costs have appeared in many of the leading newspapers and publications around the world and has taken him to over 40 countries. His career includes the authorship of over 200 research papers, articles, surveys, and editorials. Smith's latest book, Spy Trade, is an addition to his previous publications documenting and revealing that America's Israeli lobby is above the law in the United States and demonstrates that there exists a domestic espionage network in the U.S. capable of stealing secret business data that benefit the Israeli economy, shielding AIPAC from registering as an agent of foreign power and transferring America's military technology and selling it to the highest bidder around the world, all at the cost of America. The book has been hailed by former FBI agent Colleen Rowley as required background reading for those FBI agents assigned to investigate foreign espionage and public corruption matters. In Spy Trade, you give a brief history of how U.S.-Israeli alliance was formed when Harry Truman recognized Israel back in the year 1948, and subsequently how the first U.S. weapons were smuggled into Israel. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, it's fascinating because there's really kind of an above board level of entities, people, and lobbying taking place to get Truman to recognize Israel in Palestine after the close of World War II, with organizations like the Jewish Agency, which was, you know, one of these organizations that came out of Herzl's idea of putting migrants into Palestine. But then you also have below board operations going on at the same time, where the president of the Jewish Agency, David Ben-Gurion, comes to New York. He's openly registered as a foreign agent for the Jewish Agency, and he begins working with Americans to begin raising money and, more important, other resources to solidify state. But below board, he's also meeting with major organizers to begin what was the biggest arms smuggling network ever formed, which was taking advantage of the fact that the U.S. was decommissioning massive amounts of armaments after World War II. And wanted, through the administration of an entity called the War Assets Administration, control the basically decommissioning of all this, turn it into scrap metal, export a limited amount to allies. But what you have with a group called the Sonnenborg Network that Ben-Gurion met with was the beginning of a massive amount of illegal purchases of explosives, outright theft of 50 caliber machine guns from under Marine guards, the purchase of warplanes, which are supposed to be decommissioned but were instead flown to Palestine. So you have the real formation of this two-layered entity, the above board lobbying groups raising money, and this subterranean network of arms smuggling. And so we really trace that network through the present day.
And so a sense of impunity was formed, fast forwarding to the year 2010, still exists. Why?
That is one of the things we identify. There was, for example, a group of smugglers caught at the Canadian border moving weapons designs over the border. And the Royal Canadian Mounted Police told the FBI director, you've got to look into this because this is a major operation. Well, what happened was that the Jewish Agency quickly contacted some allies who had worked in the war effort in the United States to sit down with J. Edgar Hoover and basically gave him this message. if you go after these organizations, you're going to find that there's also some below ground activity taking place. And the threat was, and they said it explicitly, important individuals and organizations could be hurt. And the implication there was political figures, you know, the president, high-ranking people in government, high society people, supporters of the president. And so the threat was always, don't think that you can take this on, Mr. FBI director, and that there won't be any consequences. And so what happened was that there were some prosecutions of relatively minor figures, like Adolf Schwimmer, who had transported a lot of aircraft to Palestine, which became the nucleus of Israeli aircraft industries, and other individuals for stealing machine guns in Hawaii, Schiff. Minor prosecutions. Over time, virtually all of the felony convictions for these minor figures were unwound through presidential pardons, with the idea being that the lobby was trying to correct the historical record and turn the smugglers into heroes. And that's where the real culture of impunity from the perspective of the U.S., that there were individuals, members of the lobby, who functioned with the mindset that a crime committed in the name of Israel would not be prosecuted and should not be prosecuted in the U.S.
Spy Trade probes Israel lobby smuggling operations, diverting uranium from the U.S. to Israel's Dimona nuclear weapons facility. The Justice Department battled to regulate two enablers, the Jewish Agency and the American Zionist Council, as Israeli foreign agents back in the 1960s. But when the efforts collapsed, it unleashed election law violations and escalating intimidation of American politicians by the Israeli lobby. There was, however, some counterintelligence efforts, notably during the Kennedy administration, but that quickly fell apart, right?
Well, there was tension in the 1950s because the leaders of an organization that subsequently became the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, in the 50s known as the American Zionist Council, was taking strong positions on Capitol Hill and spending massive amounts of lobbying dollars, and beginning to launch publications attacking people who did not toe a pro-Israel line, who didn't look at the region through the talking points and positions that they were developing. And the Eisenhower administration threatened these organizations that they would revoke their tax exemptions, which is a major deal because they could suddenly no longer raise as much money. In the early 60s, there was an investigation by the Kennedy Justice Department, and more importantly by two staffers of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee under Senator J.W. Fulbright, who, with subpoena power, went into the New York offices of an organization called the Jewish Agency. Again, we go back to that, which was funding the American Zionist Council, which had put the equivalent of about $35 million so that they could lobby for arms and aid for Israel. The investigators collected tons of damaging documents showing public relations plans, showing expenditure vouchers to Isaiah Kennan, who became the founder of AIPAC. And in November of 1962, they actually ordered this organization to start registering as a foreign agent and declaring all of these activities.
Which led to the establishment of AIPAC.
Right. 6 weeks later, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee was incorporated in Washington, D.C., and essentially all of the assets from the American Zionist Council, the newsletter, the Near East Report, fundraising lists, lobbying know-how, leadership, was transferred to this new organization so that they could continue their activities, even as a massive battle between the Justice Department and the American Zionist Council, which was the umbrella organization for Hadassah, the Zionist Organization of America, a number of other groups, began behind closed doors with the American Zionist Council saying, no, we won't register, and the Kennedy administration saying, yes, you must register, and we want a full declaration of everything you've done up until now. Well, all of that ended when John F. Kennedy was assassinated. But the American Zionist Council itself ultimately folded a few years later in a final meeting in their headquarters. They basically said that they would be back, but the truth is they were already operating through the AIPAC.
And many believe that history was made to an extent with the Fulbright hearings.
What happened in May and August of 1963 was the first in-depth interrogation of leaders who were involved in laundering the money from overseas into the U.S. political process, the first in-depth look into the Near East Report, which was this lobbying newsletter currently housed within AIPAC, how it was attempting to punish people who did not toe the line. It was the first in-depth look at the public relations plan for 1962-1963, which was a full-fledged assault on Madison Avenue, academia, book publishers, magazine publishers, trying to push all of this Israeli-developed propaganda into the U.S. news stream, relations with religious groups. So people were quite shocked when they saw this within the hearing room, and there were a lot of contemporary news accounts of just how detailed the stealth campaign actually was. Ultimately, the hearing, however, failed. They looked at other lobbies for other nations, the Dominican Republic, Germany, and this ultimately led to some changes in the Foreign Agents Registration Act, which is a 1938 law that says, look, if you're lobbying with foreign dollars in the U.S., you have to show everybody what your activities are and publicly register. But it didn't have the impact. Basically, the Department of Justice gave up. They couldn't proceed after the Kennedy assassination. And the Johnson administration, which was very eager to be reelected on Johnson's merits, made peace with a lot of the groups that they were pursuing. And the entire file of the incident at the Justice Department was classified, along with a perfunctory registration statement that they ultimately filed, which was supposed to be public. They actually classified that until 2008. So nobody actually knew what happened until 2008.
In Spy Trade, Smith writes that the elite and leadership of the Israeli lobby still remain immune from criminal prosecution today. Multiple citizenship, international mobility, massive amounts of political patronage, and most importantly, credible threats of systematic risk to the U.S. government have turned law enforcement away from their harmful activities and toward initiatives that advance Israel's sovereign objectives. You have written numerous books about U.S.-Israeli relations and its consequences for America's national and international interests. What did you find out about these groups and their influence, so to say, once you decided to challenge it?
Well, what we've seen is throughout history, there have been a number of serious violations of U.S. criminal statutes. There have been violations of U.S. election law, the Foreign Agents Registration Act, the Logan Act, theft of government property, commercial espionage. There have been a lot of unpunished crimes that we've managed to eke out of the FBI and Department of Justice through the Freedom of Information Act process. What we've typically seen in case after case is that what happens between the Jewish agency and the FBI director when the weapons smuggling was uncovered was that the lobby's been successfully able to challenge the governance, the rule of law of the United States in order to escape prosecution and accountability. We saw that with the foreign agents registration attempts in the 1960s, in the 1980s. We saw that election law violations were successfully The prosecutions were successfully delayed for 20 years, even as election laws were being weakened so that there'd be no accountability for that. We've seen in subsequent years the theft of government property, classified documents on trade to improve the Israeli trade position. All well documented by the FBI, investigated, complaints by industry and affected individuals. And what we've seen is that beyond the disastrous policies that are being implemented across the region, the governance in the United States, and that the right of the people to have advice and consent governance is being subverted. So, for example, you have 60 major worker organizations and industries lobbying for the best outcome of this first bilateral intergovernmental trade pact between the United States and Israel in the 1980s. And their entire right to input into this process is subverted when all of the classified or confidential, business confidential information they give to the government, ostensibly to help them protect or expand their trade interests, is stolen and delivered by Israeli Minister of Economics Dan Halpern to the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which uses it to subvert the process and get the trade deal passed. And their interests were utterly, utterly overridden by this illegal act, which was investigated, documented, but never prosecuted. And the files about it were only released last year. So what our research has really uncovered and continues to uncover is this assault on rule of law in the United States. And that is, again, above and beyond all of the disastrous policies that have been implemented subsequently. That is the thing of most concern to us.
U.S. President Barack Obama has declared that there should be a presumption of declassification, a presumption of openness, shifting away from the secrecy that we had during the Bush administration. Do you think that there will be more openness for inquiries in the near future?
What we found initially is, although we haven't been able to get, for example, documents documenting wrongdoing in a timely fashion, for example, when we need to file amicus briefs in court, haven't gotten them on time, but we've been getting responses. So I think when in January he signed an executive order saying there has to be a presumption of openness, you can't classify something forever, I think he meant that. But in our case, the domain of information, which would fundamentally, if properly distributed, alter every American's perception of our Middle East policy, the domain of documents, which is still classified and unreleased, and probably will be fought to the last breath of some of the bureaucrats who like to protect these things in the CIA, the FBI, various intelligence agencies, even trade agencies, even mundane places, the State Department, the General Accounting, which is now the General Accountability Office, they've received the orders. But we're not entirely convinced that although we've gotten more documents in the past year than we've gotten in the entire, during the entire last part of the Bush administration, we're not convinced that these agencies are going to comply with that order. He's just the president, you know. I mean, that's a way to look at it.
So who would you say is a more influential figure than the president himself?
Well, if you look at it, the answer, the evidence seems to be in the recent activities. He came into office saying that he's going to jumpstart the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, and yet the first and smallest hurdle that he had to cross, which was simply getting a commitment from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu that they would stop building illegal settlements, he hasn't been able to get that. So he's got a lot of people at his side who probably would rather not see him get that as well. Rahm Emanuel,
David Axelrod, all of these people live and breathe for support from the Israel lobby. And whether or not they're actually on board remains to be seen. And within his diplomatic corps, George Mitchell seems to be the only one whose track record would suggest that he is actually serious about getting that commitment. But they've been utterly defeated, even toward that small gesture that they tried to get from the Israelis. So I would say again, the Kennedys were beaten by the lobby. Bush won when he tried to freeze loan guarantees, was beaten by the lobby, beaten up and beaten by the lobby. Bush too, although he didn't follow through with some of the desires of the lobby toward the end of his administration, saw the one accountability moment unwound as soon as Obama came into office, which was the prosecution of two AIPAC officials. So I'm not convinced that the whole FOIA thing is going to be as good as it's been.
You write that despite the fact that the United States has traditionally ignored and forgiven investigations into Israeli espionage activities, the cost of America's national security and economy may now have pushed law enforcement agencies towards a tipping point. The question is, do you think the reason for this is because there are too many parallels involved?
No, I think we're talking about it more now because the FBI in particular has begun pursuing cases of Israeli espionage, whether it's Ben-Ami Kadish or Stuart Nozetti. These are two recent cases, and the way they've pursued it makes it particularly difficult for it to go to the Justice Department and die, like some of the other cases. They've been very conscientious about the way they're setting up the stings so that they can steer away from the State Department, steer away from diplomatic immunity questions, and let the individuals violating the law convict themselves through wiretaps. So I think the tipping point is that there is still interest in the part on the part of some of in the law enforcement community, probably informed by industries that have been severely impacted by industrial espionage, that they need to crack down on this. It's easy to ignore it when times are good, but when times are bad economically and you see this constant drain of intellectual property that's severely undermining U.S. industries, it becomes much much more difficult to ignore it. Again, particularly when U.S. industry is insisting on accountability. Every year, the U.S. Trade Representative is forced by American industries, like the pharmaceutical makers in particular, to crack down on intellectual property violations. They don't crack down, but they do issue a report saying that it's a gigantic problem.
And what about the civil liberties case of Steve Rosen? Tell us about that.
In 2005, Stephen J. Rosen and Keith Weissman, who were both high-level employees of the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, along with Lawrence Franklin, who was a colonel at the Pentagon working under Douglas Feith, were all criminally indicted under the 1917 Espionage Act for passing information, classified national defense information, to reporters and other entities, including Israelis not entitled to have it. The prosecution never took place. It never went to trial. And between 2005 and 2009, there were a lot of court maneuvers. And when the Obama administration came into office, prosecutors dropped the case. They decided it was too difficult to prosecute. But before it was dropped in 2009, Stephen Rosen filed a civil defamation suit against the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, saying that it had defamed him by firing him and making statements to the press that his behavior was not in keeping with AIPAC standards. And that's currently hasn't gone to trial yet, but it's opening a window into some of AIPAC's activities.
You know, Israel has been termed as America's most reliable ally in the Middle East. Would you agree with that assessment?
I wouldn't, no, because I would agree with people like Michael Scheuer and Professors Walt and Mearsheimer, that an ally takes pains to respect the sovereignty of its counterparties. But in the case of the Israeli-U.S. relationship, it's a relationship of absolute dependency in which the Israelis offer the U.S. very little, and the U.S. is basically giving life support to Israel. The record of criminal activity by Israelis and their supporters in this country, if properly reviewed, suggests, and I think validates the idea that this is not an ally of the United States in any sense of the word.
That's all the time we have for this edition of The Autograph here on Press TV. Thank you for staying with us and watching. Remember, you can always send us your emails to theautograph@presstv.com. We're always looking forward to them. Until next week, in another show, goodbye.